It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, most of us want to be seen, heard, and supported by the people around us, but a lot of us are lonely. We'll talk about loneliness and finding connection and community. First, May is Skin Cancer Prevention Month. According to the Skin Cancer Foundation, there are more than 5 million diagnosed cases each year, making it America's most common cancer. 20% of Americans will develop skin cancer by the time they're 70, and if you've had at least 5 sunburns, apparently your risk of melanoma doubles. Good news, when detected early, the 5-year survival rate for melanoma is 99%. So before you head out this year for some fun in the sun, make sure you know how to protect yourself. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about skin cancer? What do you want to know about the different types, how they're detected, prevented, and treated? What about sunscreen or protective clothing? Any risk factors you've been wondering about? And have you had skin cancer? Can you share that experience with us? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Apple Bodemer is a board-certified dermatologist and an associate professor at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Bodemer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Dr. Bodemer, can you start by telling us how serious can skin cancer be? I think it isn't at the top of people's radars when it comes to worrisome kinds of cancer.
Well, I mean, we really break skin cancer down into two groups. We talk about melanoma, which is its kind of own animal. And that can range from, as you mentioned earlier, to not very serious at all if caught early, to life-threatening if caught late, especially if it's had a chance to metastasize, meaning that it's had a chance to go to other parts of the body. And often that requires chemotherapy and can be, you know, can really shorten your lifespan and impact your quality of life dramatically. The non-melanoma bucket of skin cancers, there's several of them. The two most common that we deal with are basal cell and squamous cell. And those two typically are not life-threatening unless somebody has a compromised immune system, such as a transplant patient who might be taking drugs that suppress their immune system or other illnesses that might suppress their immune system. They really don't metastasize. They can be pretty destructive locally, meaning that they can grow to pretty decent sizes. They can create wounds that won't heal, that can get infected, that can get painful if nerves get involved, and require surgery. Once the surgery is done, they're typically not something you need to worry about except getting new skin cancers and kind of staying on top of that. And some of those surgeries can leave pretty disfiguring scars. So that's kind of the short and dirty on those types of skin cancers and the risks they pose.
And we'll talk some more about detection and screening and treatment in a bit. But as with many diseases, it seems like our best bet is prevention. What are your main messages to people to lower their odds of getting the different kinds of skin cancer in the first place?
Well, the single most powerful modifiable risk factor for skin cancer is UV exposure. And it does depend a little bit on how much melanin someone has in their skin or how much pigment someone has already. So for people who maybe don't have a lot of pigment, like you know, a lot of Wisconsinites, or that is a much greater risk, they tend to have more problems with sunburns. And sunburns tend to be really the biggest risk factor, especially for melanoma, but also just chronic sun exposure over time leading to chronic DNA damage of the skin cells is really what increases the risk for the non-melanoma type skin cancers. So minimizing your exposure to UV radiation, especially if you're someone who's got fair skin. We also know that from epidemiology studies that diets high in fruit and vegetables can be protective of both non-melanoma skin cancers and melanoma. So that's something that you can do long-term. It's good for us for all kinds of reasons for our health to be eating more fruits and vegetables, but that can also help offset, you know, maybe some risk with skin cancer as well.
Let's talk about putting on that sunscreen. You've been on the Ideas Network before, and you've caught me, I will say, when you say that you said that we need to put on more sunscreen than we think we do, and we need to put it on more often and refresh it more. I'm one of the people, I'll dab a little bit on at the beginning of going out and spending time in the sun, and then I kind of forget about it. Why is that bad?
Well, so the SPF is a measure of how well that sunscreen is going to protect you against UVB radiation. And in natural sunlight, we have a combination of both UVB and UVA radiation. both can cause DNA damage that can lead to, sun damage, photo aging, and skin cancer. So that's one thing about sunscreen is really it needs to say broad spectrum. And then we also need to apply it appropriately. In laboratory settings, which is where they determine the SPF factor, they use about, kind of for everyday use, about a palm full of sunscreen should cover a body in a bathing suit. So obviously a child is going to have a smaller hand, they'll have a smaller body, but we really need to be applying that much. That can equal 1 to 2 ounces. So maybe a 4 or 5 ounce bottle of sunscreen should not be sitting on your shelf all summer long if you like to be outside at all. The other thing is that sunscreen will sweat off, it will wear off. We wipe it off with towels, with our hands, with t-shirts, and it really needs to be applied every 2 hours, no matter what SPF you're using. So some people, a lot of times, will put on an SPF of 100 and think they're covered for the day, and they are not. Because before you've had a chance to get that benefit of the extra SPF, it's worn off, sweat off, or rubbed off. So that's kind of the rule of thumb, a palm full of sunscreen to cover a body in a bathing suit and reapplying every 2 hours or after getting wet. So if you put it on, you hop in the pool and you're in the pool for, 20 minutes, you get out, you towel off to dry off. Your sunscreen has all gone onto the towel. It's doing a good job of protecting that towel, but not protecting you.
Talking to Dr. Apple Bodemer with UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, board-certified dermatologist. It is the month we think about skin cancer heading into the summer. We're talking about skin safety. You can join in with your questions and experiences at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Kathy is with us in Madison. Kathy, hi.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I lost a brother to that at 30 years old. So when the mole gets itchy in different colors, definitely go see somebody. It's 100% curable, and I'm sure you're going to agree with that at that time. So I'm an advocate. If I'm at the water park or anywhere, if I see a mole that's funny on somebody, the complete stranger, I'll tell them, hey, you should get that looked at. So we could be advocates of that, and no one else has to go.
Kathy, thank
Wisconsin's
you.
really big on that because the farmers, we're all outside, farmers, the fishermen, so it's a big thing here.
Kathy, thank you so much for sharing that. So sorry about the loss of your brother. And Kathy brought up, those moles that look suspicious or funny. Dr. Bodemer, what kind of warning signs can we watch for and say, I better get this one checked out soon?
Yeah, well, anything that's changing over time is that's really important to get that looked at. We have our A, B, C, D, and then we have added in the E. So something that's asymmetric, something that has kind of a fuzzier or lobulated border. Color, it's common for people to have two different colors in a mole. When we start seeing three different colors, or especially colors that are really different from each other, like pinks and blacks together, or pinks and dark browns together, that gets us much worried rather than like a light tan and a dark tan. So those disparate colors are important. And then diameter, that's really a loose one. We often say bigger than a pencil eraser, but some people just make big moles, and that's kind of them. And a big mole isn't necessarily bad in somebody who has that constitution. But really the biggest one is something that's out of character from everything else you've got, and something that's changing over time. So I call it the bad egg and evolving. So those are really, and it's important to watch your skin, to look at it. And I recommend everybody look at their skin once a month or at least every other month so that you're comfortable with the kinds of moles you've got and the kinds of moles your body makes. You're going to be much better off in terms of catching something early that's new or changing.
And Kathy brought up another interesting point. I think a lot of us might think, oh, I'm going to the beach, I'm going to put on sunscreen, or I'm out by the pool all day, I'm going to put on sunscreen. She mentioned the people who are, farmers or other people who work outside regularly or people out in their fishing boat. Can you talk about their need for sunscreen, even though, only some of them is going to be exposed?
Yeah, well, I mean, it is just important that you protect those exposed areas. The other thing just to highlight about water, there's a lot of boaters in Wisconsin throughout the state, and fishermen and water recreation is a big thing, especially in the summer. And what the UV radiation will reflect right off of the water. So that's a time where people might be wearing hats or they might think they're protecting themselves. They maybe have a covering on the boat that directs them. That blocks them direct from the direct sunlight hitting them, but we also have to think about that incident UV radiation from the reflection, and that can happen on water, sand, also in the winter on snow and ice. It's something we still have to think about.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking about how to protect ourselves from the sun's ultraviolet rays with Dr. Apple Bodimer, board-certified dermatologist and an associate professor at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about skin cancer and sun protection? Have you yourself experienced melanoma or other types of skin cancer? Do you feel like you're doing a pretty good job of keeping on sunscreen when you need it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. May is Skin Cancer Awareness Month, so we're talking about sun protection, risk factors, and skin cancer detection and treatment with Dr. Apple Bodimer. She's a board-certified dermatologist, associate professor at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about skin cancer, sunscreen, sun exposure, tanning, burns, moles, and more. Or your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Go back to your calls now. Jordan is with us in Marengo. Jordan, hi.
Hey there, how's it going?
All right, what do you want to tell us about, Jordan?
Well, in the early 80s, when I first moved to Madison to go to college, I ended up with a suspicious mole on my left flank. By the time I got to Students Health Services, it had sunk a root down into the blood-bearing area of my skin, and they told me I was very likely to have serious trouble within 5 years. And pretty much 5 years after that, it came back, metastasized into my lymph nodes, and they told me at UW Hospital that I will be dead in 3 years. And basically, I walked away. I never went back. I never went back for any supplemental follow-ups or anything. I figured I'd just live out my days. Well, it's been 30 years now and I'm still here. And so, yeah, I want to assure people that the the chances of a negative outcome are pretty real. But my real question is, I've reached out to a couple cancer research places because it's very rare. I mean, about 1% of the population spontaneously rejects melanoma after a metastasis. And I'm just wondering if my DNA is useful to anybody. So there it is. Thanks.
Jordan, thanks for the call. Sorry you went through that. Glad you beat the odds, though. I guess it sounds like Dr. Bodimer, can you talk about that?
Yeah, it is. Well, I said melanoma is a very unpredictable cancer. And he's right. He really dodged a big bullet, especially back then. You know, the drugs we had weren't that good. And, you know, any metastatic melanoma really was a death sentence for most people. You know, I have a patient that I've took care of at the VA who had a similar situation. It was in his brain, his liver, it was everywhere. And he lived for 30 years. Nobody knows why. And, you know, there's just things we can't explain about melanoma. I think even a lot of oncologists would agree. It's just a really tricky, it's a tricky cancer. And there's a lot of differences between melanomas from person to person and between our own immune systems and what we're able to do. And at this point, I'm not aware of any studies looking at specifically DNA of people who have had kind of basically spontaneous remission of very advanced melanoma. But, you know, I think that would be something just to keep an eye out for. Yeah, I'm not aware of any ongoing current studies on that. But yeah, you know, that's really an amazing story. And I'm so glad that you had that outcome.
Well, and Jordan's story really hammers home your point about catching melanoma early, and I guess illustrates the difference it can make if you can catch it early before it goes into that state, gets into other organs and metastasizes.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens then when you've got that diagnosis, you've got that early melanoma? Can you talk a little bit about the treatment for that?
Yeah, so for an early melanoma, we look at them and we want to know if it's broken through the bottom layer of the skin. And if it hasn't, we call that melanoma in situ. And those melanomas, we've just cut them out. We take 5 millimeter margins and we kind of go down. We make sure that we didn't leave behind any cells that could come back and misbehave. And for the most part, that's really all that happens. Now, those people are at risk for developing second melanomas, but the risk for that particular melanoma to metastasize is very, very low. you know, the next stage is sort of if it has broken through that basal layer of the skin and has kind of gone into the dermal tissues, we really want to know how deep, and do we think it's had access to the blood and lymphatic system? And that really is a measure. The pathologists measure the depth from our biopsy specimens or our excision specimens, and that gives us an idea of whether or not we really need to be thinking about going in doing lymph node sampling. And so if you're at a stage with a lymph node sampling, if you come out with negative lymph nodes, that's also a really good sign. And, you know, obviously if the lymph nodes are positive, then we move on forward and look for metastases in other places with scans. And then that's when, if we find it, that's when we kind of think about chemotherapy, immunotherapy, some of the new really amazing drugs that have come out in the last 5 years or so.
Thanks again for that call, Jordan. We'll go to Karen next in Sparta. Karen, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about, Karen?
Hi. Well, I have had psoriasis since I've been like 12 years old. So I am under the regular care of a dermatologist. I have used light therapy, UVB light therapy, for most of my life. I'm 60 years old. And so I get checked quite regularly for any kind of cancerous stuff. Well, my question is, if you emphasize the broad spectrum sunscreen, why do they make anything that's not? That's what I just don't understand. Mm-hmm. If it's such a necessity, why are we even making sunscreen that is not broad spectrum?
Oh, interesting, Karen. Thanks for the call. Dr. Bodimer?
Yeah, that's a good question. Our sunscreen regulation in the United States is really not optimal. And a part of it is that even across the world, we don't have good ways of measuring UVA protection. So one of the safeguards that you can use is really looking for physical blocker sunscreen. So when we think about sunscreens, we have physical blockers and chemical blockers. And the chemical blockers do a pretty decent job at blocking UVB, but we really have no way of measuring how well they're blocking UVA. And they often need to be combined. Whereas the physical blockers are more of a force shield, is the way I think of them. They go on the skin. So that's zinc oxide, titanium dioxide, and now iron oxide is kind of hitting the market and getting more popular. So they, UV radiation will actually hit them and deflect off of them. When we're dealing with the chemical blockers, UV radiation, both UVA and UVB, I'm sorry, will hit those chemical blockers and they get absorbed and turned into heat. So I think I have not seen a sunscreen now that's marketed recently that does not say broad spectrum or says UVA and UVB. It's just that we have no way of really measuring or having good quality control around how much UVA protection a lot of those sunscreens are giving us.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Dr. Apple Bodimer, a dermatologist and associate professor at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at skin cancer prevention and detection and treatment. Back to your calls now. Tom is on the line in Green Bay. Tom, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is, like from Cabela's, I just ordered a shirt, and I noticed that in there it says it blocks UVA, UVB, something like that. Does it matter what kind of material that the cloth is made out of? Is a long sleeve T-shirt that's made out of cotton the same as a long sleeve T-shirt made out of nylon?
Tom, thanks. Great question, Dr. Bodimer. Does the kind of clothing matter?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, so when you've got those UV radiation protective clothing, they usually have a UPF factor rating. 50 is the most common. And what that means is no matter what the fabric is made out of, that it will block 1/50th, or it'll block everything except 1/50th of the UV radiation that it gets exposed to. So they really do a great job of protecting us against UV radiation. When we're thinking about just fabrics that don't have that rating, then it matters on the color. So lighter colors block less than darker colors. And also the weave. And one good rule of thumb is if you can hold it up to a light bulb and you can see light through the fabric, that's about as much UV radiation is going to get through that. So, you know, a sheer lightweight cotton top that might be light pink or light blue or pastel is going to feel very cool in the summertime, but it's also going to let a lot more UV radiation in than a darkly covered, tightly woven fabric. Now, cotton, you can find all different kind of weaves for cotton. It can be tight weave. It can be loosely weaved. Denim, there's a lot of denim out there that is cotton, and denim is very, very dense and offers pretty decent protection. The other trick is if it doesn't have that UPF rating, it's going to drop that protection as soon as it gets wet. You know, so even like a dark navy, tightly woven cotton long sleeve shirt, once it gets wet, you really, really diminish that UV protection. Whereas those UPF rated clothing, they don't diminish their UV protection once they get wet. So
thanks
good
a
for
lot
you for
that.
Getting that shirt and use it a lot this summer.
All right. Good call then, Tom. Another Tom now. Tom in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I tanned very well, but as a child, this is before sunscreens, we went in the winter from Wisconsin to Miami, Florida, and I got burned quite severely a couple of times. So I wondered, is the risk cumulative? Are you more at risk being a child than being burned?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the risks are greater when you have the sunburns earlier on in life. We do know that. So childhood sunburns, especially sunburns that lead to blistering, will definitely increase your risk of skin cancer, especially melanoma, because with melanoma, we know it's high intensity intermittent exposure. With the other types of skin cancer, it's more of a clock that kind of just keeps ticking. It's just the chronic long-term exposure and the chronic sunburns that really will add up and accumulate to increase the risk of those types of skin cancer.
Tom, thanks a lot for that call. And Dr. Bodemer, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Dr. Apple Bodemer, a board-certified dermatologist and an associate professor at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. We talked to her today about skin cancer and how to protect ourselves from the sun's UV rays, especially as we enter into the summer. Coming up after the news, talking about loneliness can be hard, but lots of people are going through it, especially young people. We'll talk about what your loneliness could mean and how to think about building your community and your connections. You can join in now with your stories, questions, and suggestions over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at a community policing project in Racine featuring cop houses aimed at building connections between law enforcement and local residents. That's tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show. Now, on surveys and studies of loneliness, younger generations repeatedly show some of the highest levels of being lonely. And the pandemic has raised challenges for people of all ages when it comes to finding connections. But our next guest says we can find ways to connect, and it's worth the effort. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How do you handle feeling lonely? Where have you found community in our modern world, pre-pandemic or now? Are there online groups or in-person meetups you've tried in order to feel more connected? Did you have a lonely time of your life? Is it now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Rainsford Stauffer is a writer. Her new book is called An Ordinary Age, Finding Your Way in a World That Expects Exceptional. She joined us last week to talk about the book. We're welcoming her back for a second conversation after our connection was cut short because of technical issues. Rainsford, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me back.
Well, I mentioned those survey numbers, Rainsford, finding a lot of loneliness among young people, and it sounds like that was no surprise to you. You've been talking to younger people, and you hear stories of loneliness again and again. What kind of things do you run into?
Right. What's so interesting about this is that obviously this past year has been lonely for a lot of people in a lot of different ways. But we also know that young people, people ages roughly 18 to 35, were ranking high on the scale of loneliness when surveyed anyway. I think that one of the things that we sometimes look over about young adulthood is that it's a real transitional point of life. Regardless of whether you're going from high school into the workforce, or you're moving to college, or you're graduating, maybe you're moving cities, we kind of find ourselves adrift without maybe the built-in social structures that we were used to having, either with our family or with peers at a certain job or even peers in school. And it can lead to feeling really lonely. I think the compounding effect of that is everyone thinks that they're the only one experiencing loneliness. So we end up being lonely within that. We think that it's a problem with us, that we're the one that can't make friends, or we're not putting ourselves out there the right way. When really, one of the things I learned while reporting the book is that loneliness in and of itself isn't a bad thing. And that's something I wish we talked about more.
Why is that? Why, it seems like feeling lonely is bad. Why isn't it a bad thing?
Absolutely. One of the experts I spoke to laid this out really well. First, there's a difference between chronic loneliness, which is social isolation that is enduring. It's where someone really doesn't feel like they have the resources or the community support they need to establish a sense of connection. But loneliness, when it's not chronic, isn't necessarily a bad thing, because it's kind of like feeling thirsty or feeling hungry. It's signaling to your body and to your brain that you're in need of something, that you're in need of a connection, that you're in need of other people. And I think that that's something that kind of goes overlooked in these conversations, because first of all, it's scary to need other people. It's hard to admit that maybe you can't do it all by yourself, or you don't want to do it all by yourself. And I think that that really requires us getting away from this hyper-individualism that tells us that we should be able to stand alone and do everything by ourselves, when in reality, we all need people. None of us were meant to go it alone.
That reminds me of one thing that really struck me in your chapter on loneliness, is a lot of people felt ashamed of being lonely, or they were doing it wrong. There were failures, especially young people who are thinking, I'm at the age where I'm supposed to be, you know, out and partying and hanging out with people all the time. How have I failed? Can you talk about that reaction?
Right. So we have this mentality of kind of what young adult life is going to be, even though we know that that often doesn't match the economics or realities or just personal circumstances someone's existing in. But we think generally of best friends that we can tell all our secrets to, kind of being surrounded by a wide circle of people, or on the flip side, being so independent and so brave that we're comfortable doing things alone. And being able to do things alone and being self-reliant, those are wonderful attributes. But I think that when we talk about young adulthood especially, we've kind of left out the other half of the messaging, which is that not only have you not failed if you're lonely, being lonely is a signal that you need people, that you want to open up your life and you want to figure out ways to foster that community. And that's a really good thing. I think that when we admit that we're lonely, it hopefully sucks the stigma out of the fact that this is a really ordinary experience and a sensation that most of us are probably going to have in some capacity at some point in our life.
We're talking to Rainsford Stauffer, author of the new book, An Ordinary Age, Finding Your Way in a World That Expects Exceptional. We're focusing in on her chapter on loneliness, very common among younger people, according to surveys and according to conversations she had with a lot of people. It can happen, of course, to anybody at any age. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, thoughts, and maybe your experiences with loneliness now or at some point in your life. Do you have advice for other people on how to come out of it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. So, Rachel, you said loneliness is a sign that we need that connection. You know, thirst, everybody would need to drink some liquid. If we're hungry, we need some food. But it seems like the cure for loneliness might be different for you than it would be for me or somebody else.
Absolutely. That was one of the most enlightening things I found while I was reporting this chapter. We don't all need the same amount of social interaction. We're not all going to find fulfillment in the same kinds of communities or relationships. It really requires that we kind of, ironically, for being lonely, look inward and think about what you want out of a relationship and what you need. one of the things that came up in my reporting during this chapter from an expert that I thought was so interesting was the idea of social health and kind of the emotional immune system, which I think is so prevalent right now since it is Mental Health Awareness Month, that we need to figure out what version of this works for us. Just because you know you need community doesn't mean you should feel guilty that you're not going out with new people every single night or trying to make new friends. In a lot of cases, what we need isn't even a best friend at all. It's just knowing we've got people in our corner and kind of those loose tie connections that make up our day-to-day lives.
If I conjured up a mental image of loneliness, I guess it would be a person sitting alone in a room. But that's not necessarily what it looks like, right? You talk about that the alone in a crowd phenomenon. Why can we feel lonely even when we're surrounded by people?
Definitely. I think that that stems from needing different things out of different social circumstances. There were actually a lot of young people I talked to that described technically being surrounded by people, whether it was in a social setting or it was at work or some other extracurricular kind of community event, and feeling deeply lonely. And in those instances, what they explained is that they were around people, yes, but they didn't feel understood. They didn't understand how to reach out and make a connection or why people seemingly didn't want to do that with them. And they felt a little bit out of place. I think that that's another reason why it's so important to prioritize different kinds of connections and different sorts of friendship. So when we think of loneliness, it's not just sitting alone in a crowded room. The antidote to loneliness is finding the kind of community that fulfills you.
We're talking with Rainsford Stauffer about loneliness. She focuses on that topic in part of her new book, An Ordinary Age, Finding Your Way in a World That Expects Exceptional. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you felt loneliness at some point in your life? Were you able to come out of it? If so, how? Have you found ways to cultivate relationships with people, add friends to your roster of connections, even if they're not your best friend? Have you turned people from acquaintances into sort of that middle range of friends? How do you do that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking with Rainsford Stauffer about her new book, An Ordinary Age, Finding Your Way in a World That Expects Exceptional. We're talking about loneliness, friendship, and community. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your experiences, maybe your solutions. You can also send us an email, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Rainsford, a big thing about that age, that new adult age that you talk about in your chapter on loneliness is, you know, we're coming out of a situation, whether it's, you know, high school or college, where we're kind of thrown in with people. You have no choice in some ways to make friends. Now, all of a sudden, you're in this situation, I don't know, where it feels weird to go up and say, you know, will you be my friend? How can we start to learn to cultivate people when we're outside of that sort of captive environment of, say, school?
It is so much harder in some ways. I heard from a lot of people realizing that they'd never had to, as they put it, put in effort to make a friend. It seemed like there were always just sort of friendships around to be forged, and that those things unfolded very naturally. And then as you enter a more adult stage of your life, or one in which your social circle isn't condensed to a given area, you realize that between fatigue from work, keeping up with everything like grocery shopping, trying to take care of yourself, it's really hard to have the energy to maintain friendships or to make new friendships too. And so one of the things that I heard about from people was the idea of establishing a routine. Whether it was making a routine phone call once a week at a standing time to a friend you knew from college or high school, whether it was showing up at a meeting or a club or a volunteering event when things were still happening in person, it was about putting something on the calendar and making a commitment to doing it. And I think that that helped people in a couple ways. The first being that, you know, it's easy to think, oh, well, I'll do that next week. Right now, I'm really tired. And it kind of establishes this routine that getting to know other people is going to be part of what we do over the course of the day. I also think it helps to get people over that initial awkward first moment of trying to meet a new group or engage with a new community. None of us like to be uncomfortable, but when we can keep showing up and keep figuring out how to put ourselves out there, it gives people the opportunity to reach back out to us as well.
There's also a question about how to set the bar for those new friendships, because I think people might think of friend as that all-in, ride-or-die BFF, and we can actually get a lot of benefit from something somewhere between that and just the casual acquaintance. Can you talk about those middle-level friends?
I love that one of the people I spoke to in this book talked about what she called medium friends. And I thought that was a great description, because it's kind of like, on one hand, we've got the ride or die best friends that are almost like family. And on the other hand, it's like we've got a bunch of acquaintances whose last names we may or may not know. And I think that in the middle, there's actually a lot of value and maybe less pressure. These might be people that you meet at work and get a coffee with after work one day. You might meet them because you volunteer for the same organization and you have that in common. They're people that may not know your deepest, darkest secrets, but they show up and they create a sense of community when you need them to, and vice versa. And I think that that's what's so cool about those relationships, and realizing that you can have friends of different backgrounds, friends you go to with different things, friends of all different ages, and they each bring something unique to your life. I think if we can stop thinking about friendship as sort of a one-size-fits-all thing that it's supposed to be, and expand our ideas of what it means to be in community with other people, will go a long way in figuring out how to navigate those feelings of loneliness.
Talking to Rainsford Stauffer, her new book is called An Ordinary Age, Finding Your Way in a World That Expects Exceptional. We're talking about loneliness and how to come out of it. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your questions or your experiences. Rainsford, you mentioned at the outset, one thing we don't do much is talk about loneliness, so everybody thinks they're the only ones who are alone. Can you talk about the value of talking about it?
I think talking about it is one of the first ways we start kind of weaving our way through it. I didn't know until I started reporting this book that second to old age, young adulthood is actually one of the loneliest times of our life. And so when we're sitting there thinking, oh my gosh, something's wrong with me, I'm the one that can't make friends, I think it's helpful to realize that it's a really ordinary sensation. And I think talking about it gives us the opportunity to realize that. I got so many messages that said a version of, well, I know I'm responsible for my own happiness, but, and then going into feeling guilt or shame about being lonely. And while I don't think anyone is debating that self-reliance and having an active role in your own happiness is important, I think that we've really underestimated how much we all need other people. And I think that sometimes saying that out loud is truly the hardest part.
Can you talk about the distinction between solitude as a voluntary thing versus loneliness?
Absolutely. There are a lot of instances where feeling solitude is actually a profoundly comforting thing. When it's voluntary, when it's something that you're choosing, like you know you need to spend the evening just kind of hanging out with yourself, it can feel incredibly healing. It can create great space to pause and reflect. It can be a nice breather from a world that is incredibly overstimulating. Loneliness, on the other hand, is your social needs not being met. You're not choosing to hang out with yourself. You're not choosing not to be around other people or to be in community with them. It's something that you feel like you're lacking or that you need. And I think that that's a really important distinction, because I've heard from a lot of people that think, well, I need my alone time. It's what makes me happy. And I think that that's exactly the point. A lot of the time, solitude and being by ourselves is what's going to make us happy. It's just that that's not the same thing as being lonely.
How does social media fit into all of this? On the one hand, it can make us feel sort of connected. On the other hand, it can make it look like everybody's having so much more fun than we are.
I think that's such a great question, because it was one I got to really hear both sides of while thinking about this and reporting on this for the book. A lot of people did talk about kind of the sinking feeling you get when you get on Instagram and you see a photo of a bunch of people you thought were your friends out somewhere where you weren't invited. or you look at social media and think, well, everyone is out doing something and I'm sitting at home alone. So in those instances, it really can drive home this idea that I'm the only one who must be lonely. But on the flip side of that, young people talked about all the ways they'd really use social media as a means of finding community. They joined groups, they made friends, they were able to see versions of their identities represented that they couldn't safely in their real day-to-day lives. And so I think in that way, it can be a really powerful tool. I always think of one of the tips that an expert I interviewed in this chapter gave to overcoming loneliness in regard to social media, which is that instead of passively scrolling through it and looking at other people's lives, we can decide to message them and kind of play a small part in it. We can send them a little compliment. We can send them a message. Hey, don't know if you remember me, but thinking of you, how are you doing? We can try to use social media as a tool to create community and reach out where we can.
Even if we're not the lonely one, Rainsford, it seems like from you talking to people from the surveys out there, there's a good chance that someone in our social circles is dealing with loneliness at any given time. How can we, I don't know, up our loneliness radar and reach out to those people and help them build those connections?
Oh, I love that. I think the great thing about reaching out to people is it's not just a benefit to them. It's also a benefit to you. It's a benefit to us because the richer our communities are, the more invested we are in other people. It gives them the opportunity to become part of our lives and invest in us in the same way. I think that a good thing to keep in mind is that whether you're lonely right now or can't imagine being, we're all going to hit a point in our lives where we feel like we're in it alone. And I think it can be as simple as maybe getting back in touch with a friend or family member you haven't talked to in a while. If you see someone new at work or at school, maybe making the effort to reach out to them first, even if it is via social media, if that's the kind of relationship you have and that's the comfort level. I think when we can realize that it's not just us feeling lonely, and that where we can be the ones to help someone else work their way through loneliness, we all end up feeling closer together and like we're more seen and heard and supported.
I want to bring this home, Rainsford, to something you touched on earlier that there's really an overarching point, I think, in your book, not just the loneliness chapter, the tension between, especially for that emerging adult, I should be able to handle everything. I should be able to do it all on my own versus the need we have for connection. How can we do a little of both successfully?
Absolutely. I think that this is such a thing for young adults, but really I think it impacts all of us across our lifespan. The idea that being self-reliant and needing other people are inherently contradictory ideas. I think first it requires us talking about the fact that they aren't. We weren't designed to handle everything in our lives alone. We weren't designed to go through it alone. And when you stop and think about it, you think about the moments of your own life that felt especially good or especially fulfilling. Chances are they were happening in some form of community with other people. You wanted to share them with someone. So I think that if we can spin this hyper-individualism into I'm going to rely on other people and I'm going to let them rely on me, I think that what we come to is a more inclusive, warm, fulfilling world and relationships with other people in our various communities, whether that's best friends or coworkers or neighbors.
We'll leave it there. Rainsford, we made it without losing our connection today. Thank you so much for coming back to us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Rainsford Stauffer, writer and author of the new book, An Ordinary Age, Finding Your Way in a World That Expects Exceptional. She joined us today to talk about loneliness and finding community. Well, if you have a story to share, if you've gone through loneliness and come through on the other side, send us an email. Tell us about it, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. By the way, we've got an ongoing question right now on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Are you in the housing market? What are you seeing? Are there bidding wars? Is it tough if you're a buyer? Are you feeling very flattered if you're a seller? Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, in 1870, about half the people in Wisconsin were from New York State, including dispossessed Native Americans, abolitionists, and farmers. A Wisconsin historian shares his newly award-winning work called Whose Land? And it's a flowery edition of Food Friday with a look at edible flowers, how to grow them, and how to use them in our cooking. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. The Brewers played today, and it marked another big milestone and one of the biggest stories of the season for the team. Producer Bill Martins is keeping track. Hey, Bill.
Hey, and it happened against the Cardinals, Rob, which makes the story even better. So Corbin Burnes, we talked about him a few weeks ago, Brewer right. starting pitcher. He was chasing the record for most strikeouts without a walk to start the season. He was at 30-something. Well, he kept going. Now, the record was 51 by Kenley Jansen of the Dodgers, and he was a closer, so only pitching maybe an inning per game, Burnes needed 3 strikeouts heading into today's game to break the record. Rob, he got 8, but then he walked a guy, wow. so the streak ends at 58. But man, what a run.
Okay, now you're burying an important part of the story. What had just happened when he walked that batter breaking the streak, Bill?
It's kind of my fault. I had checked the right. Brewers website to fire up the game tracker thing, and I noticed that they were streaming the video right on their site, and I thought, oh, cool. 2 pitches later, no joke, ball 4. So sorry, everybody.
You know, Bill, I'm not a superstitious person, except for sports jinxes. There, I'm very superstitious. I don't really think it was your fault, though. Well, Bill, thanks for the update. Now he's got to start a new – he's got to break the record starting fresh.
That's exactly. Well, he got 1 after that walk, so he's on the way.
He's on the way. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.